here's the question. In the print and packaging supply chain, how do we deliver new ideas and innovative practices to continually improve your profit, your brand, and your quality? Welcome to the Gamut Podcast, and I am your host, Jeff Collins, Director of Print Technologies for ID Alliance. We are a nonprofit global think tank serving the graphic communications industry with 12 offices strategically located around the world to better support our membership. You can support the Gamut Podcast and content like this by becoming a member at ID Alliance by going to www.idalliance.org. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Canon USA. They provide industry-leading production and large format printing solutions supported by exceptional professional service offerings. With the technology offerings of the Canon and Osei brands and a vast portfolio of toner-based and inkjet solutions, Canon USA helps companies of all sizes to find ways to improve sustainability, increase efficiency, and control costs in conjunction with high volume, continuous feed, digital and traditional printing, and workflow solutions. Canon USA is headquartered in Melville, New York, and has sales and service locations across the United States and throughout the world. On today's Gamut Podcast, we have a very special guest, David Luckshus. He is the president and CEO of Cog LLC, and David founded Cog in 2010 to add value to the packaging development process. He was mentored by the legendary Lou Dorfman in the New York City advertising Mad Men Badlands, and David has since been a designer at several agencies, creative director at Barefoot Advertising, merchandising design director at Marshall Brand Partners, and a design manager at Procter & Gamble. So he's seen the need from the other side for talented partners, and now he and the COGS team help all stakeholders in the design to print process, working towards the same goal, only smarter, faster, and more cost-effectively. And let's give a warm welcome to David. David, good morning. Welcome to the Gamut Podcast. We're excited to hear from you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
To start, I want to bring up your website and the extremely insightful, on-point information. I mean, it's each part that you go to on that website, and that's cogdriven.com, C-O-G. D-R-I-V-E-N, and you have great information on the what you term the design to print supply chain and the packaging development engine and how you guys fit. But there's so many things that struck me as being important in the packaging industry, and more so on the core philosophy. And I would love to ask you about TAO and balance and, you know, maintaining that flow. And of course, if those if our listeners aren't familiar with TAO, it's an Eastern philosophy or religion, but it talks about, you know, for me, my perception of it is, you know, bringing order out of chaos, duality, and that area in between that where we can, you know, walk that path and you have a natural flow to the universe. And of course, I'll probably edit that part out, but because I may not be articulating it perfectly, but in my life, and my father studied Eastern religions as a child. We instead of going to church, went to a Buddhist vihara from Sri Lanka.
Oh wow!
Stationed outside of Washington D.C. area, around just north of Embassy Row, and he studied that. He still does. It's been, you know, his passion, and it's what keeps him on the straight and narrow. I really want to get into what inspired you to gravitate to design and packaging. I noticed that you did some interesting work with forensics and autopsies.
Yeah.
And the medical industry.
Wow. Wow. You really did your research.
Yeah, I love stuff like that. I mean, you know,
I actually went to college to study for medical illustration. I was an undergraduate. I was an art major, a fine art major, and a pre-med minor. And I had known about the field of medical illustration from my aunt, who was a real, she was a real unsinkable Molly Brown type, and a great influence in my life. And of course, you know, a career like a path like medical illustration is not something that a college or a high school counselor knew about. So I was aware of this field because she knew that I loved. I was like most little boys who wanted to grow up and be several things. Like I wanted to be an artist and a brain surgeon, you know, and like other boys want to be a fireman and a astronaut, you know. Right. We always grow up wanting to be several things. And so she didn't dissuade me. She actually said, well, you can do both. And I heard about this career early on and began to prepare in high school for that, knowing that I'd have to go to grad school, which was pretty rigorous. So I created a major in undergraduate that the college actually accepted. And part of my co-op, well, my co-op programs involved working at a pathology lab at a local hospital where I observed and assisted about two dozen autopsies, forensic as well as general. You know, at that point in my life, I mean, it was a very humbling and eye-opening experience, essentially what we're made of and literally made of, how close we are to not being here. So I think it gave me a level of urgency that was sort of uncommon at that age, but it stayed with me, obviously.
David, I want to read something directly from you. This is what you wrote on improving processes. And I love this. I don't think I've heard process improvement quite articulated or quite described like this from an experience. So here we go. And this is you, Dave. To prepare myself for the gruesome realities of becoming a medical illustrator, I spent two co-op tours with a hospital pathology department, assisting in general and forensic autopsies. You could say, and this is where it's good, you could say the experience gave me a discerning eye for dissecting terminally ill, again, terminally ill, designed to print processes, and initiatives to understand how they can work better. Or you could say, I need to get out more. I'm pretty sure that'll stand the test of time. It's a perennial statement.
That's
terminally
fine.
Ill designed to print processes and initiatives. And this is one of the obstacles that we see, that there's poorly designed or design concepts that don't make sense when it moves on to the next stage or down the supply chain as far as process capability and things like that. So can you tell me or talk to us and let our listeners know, one, you're the president and CEO of COG, and what does COG do for the print and packaging industry?
Great. Well, first of all, the name of the company, COG, I have to clarify that because we are in Cincinnati, and that is the acronym capital of the world, if you didn't know that.
No, not.
But COG is actually a word, and it is, you know, the literal definition of a COG is a projection on the edge of a gear wheel that engages with other corresponding parts on another wheel to transfer motion from one wheel to another. It's really when my partners and I first got together, you know, we really talked about what role we want to play relative to how the design to print supply chain is evolving. Mm-hmm. And we decided early on that the outages that we see in the design to print process that never seem to get corrected, no matter what our end customers' purchasing departments do in the way of creating efficiency or driving down cost, the process never gets better. And then people who are experienced in this business get downsized or retire. and then a whole new generation of young people come in, and the process never gets better. So we decided to attack that, and we found that the only way we could do that is if we first understand all of the key stakeholders in the supply chain, which means we decided we're not going to be a key stakeholder. We're going to be a small essential component, and that we're going to focus on the big stakeholders. And we see them as R&D packaging, right, design, printing and converting, and material substrate and coatings developers. Those to us are the key stakeholders in terms of driving innovation to the packaging industry. So our whole position, our whole point of being is to support those four areas and to not try to grow to the point where we're replacing anyone. We're very content to be a cog in the wheel because, in our opinion, that's what the process needs.
Right. And the image of a cog and the image of the symbol for Tal. It's very similar. Mm-hmm. They fit and they work and they flow, or it adds flow.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. Like our elevator speech is that we're a consumer packaging development company, and we specialize in creating superior consumer engagement with brands. But the services and solutions we provide during those critical packaging development phases are really meant to achieve four things. One is to facilitate front-end innovation. Two is to optimize design to print, which I think you're speaking to mostly.
Yeah.
And then third is to accelerate speed to market. And then the fourth and final one is to reduce and avoid costs throughout the design to print process.
Right, right. And now, how did you come to be in the process improvement part of the design to print? You started, you know, as a designer, and then you in the early 90s, mm-hmm. you worked for a New York City advertising agency, and you mentioned some legends, Jerry Della Famina.
Della Famina, yeah.
Yeah, Della Famina, Mary Wells, and then you mentioned Lou Dorsman as your coach and mentor.
Yeah.
Tell me about the things, or tell me about what was attractive to your mentors. What did they instill in you, and then how did that lead to where you're at now?
Well, I think as far as role models go, Mary Wells is probably, like, her story is probably one of the main inspirations to my career. I never met her, but she was the president and CEO of Wells Rich Green, which was a famous ad agency back in the Mad Men era. Mm-hmm. She was essentially the first woman badass in advertising. And a boss of mine, a big influence, Dick Jackson, creative director, a copywriter during that Mad Men era. He worked for her, and Dick introduced me to Lou Dorsman. And Lou Dorsman he passed away, you know, several years ago, but he was a legend in the design and art direction industry. He was the creative director for CBS for about 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I loved Lou Dorfman's design style, but what I really saw in his prolific career was that he touched everything. He touched everything about CBS from a design standpoint. And early on, I began to feel that to be a true designer, you had to have an understanding and respect for every touch point that a brand has, and that they have to be integrated.
Right.
And as I... You know, as I advanced, you know, my design career, my creative career, working from that principle, I eventually came across Procter & Gamble. I got a job with Procter & Gamble as a design manager, which was a real eye opener in terms of, hey, I'm working for the client side now. I'm really understanding, you know, the marketing objectives, the ability of creative ideas and concepts to successfully accomplish those objectives from the client side. So I really began to broaden my awareness of what creative, what successful creative really entailed. Unlike, you know, when I was just a New York snob working in Madison Avenue. But the other thing I learned, Jeff, which really influenced COG tremendously, is that working at Procter & Gamble, I saw that no one was integrating within P&G or within the agency world. No one was integrating traditional advertising with web, with direct mail, with packaging, and with PR. No one was integrating these things. They were all seen as separate disciplines. Mm-hmm. And that's where I began to see a lot of outages, because things that I was managing, either from a print promotion standpoint or a packaging standpoint for P&G, I could see were not being shared, those learnings, as well as how a file is prepped.
Right.
You know, we're not being shared with the other disciplines. And that's where the light really went off that, hey, this is a valuable role that doesn't exist yet. And I eventually, COG is a result of addressing that.
I see. And when we talk about design concepts, mm-hmm. and helping a brand realize that design concept, and then, as I mentioned before, when we start to look downstream to where mm-hmm. it needs to be manufactured, what is the process from that design concept once, I mean, how do you really give a brand the green light that this particular design concept is okay and it's efficient and it will work, and here's your the supplier that can pull it off? Do you have an auditing process? Can you walk our listeners through that?
Sure. That's a great question. So first of all, just for a little perspective, our company is placed in the same bucket or category as comp houses.
Mm-hmm.
When we started the company, we didn't like that. We told purchasing people, design people, you know, we're different. We have no competitors, and it's kind of silly, in retrospect, because when you're that different, we learned no one can actually use you. You have to belong. They have to be able to place you somewhere in order to use you. So we grudgingly accepted, okay, we'll work. We'll accept being in the comp house prototyping category, even though we think we're different. And in retrospect, it was laughable because we really wasted a lot of time by being so stubborn about it. So why that's important is that, generally speaking, comp houses, prototyping houses, are creating glamour comps. They're producing an output, either a label or a carton, that is meant to guide the design process and ultimately be shown to a brand owner to get approval. The problem with that offering and that approach is that those comps are not printable. They're not feasible. They're not rooted in what the printer can actually bring to the table. The printer's actually been treated over the last 10, 15 years as, you know, further down the supply chain.
Right.
We view the printer and the design people as the only craftspeople in that supply chain, and that they're essential that they work together early. So our process is to use our digital equipment, prototyping equipment, to mimic what the printer can do in the millions and produce iterative or final comps outputs for the design firm early in the process that are rooted in the printer's feasibility. And that way, we're managing expectations. And, while we're producing beautiful output, we're also producing what the printer can do. And the printer can often do things that they're not asked to do just because they've got no time to do it, or they've been included. They haven't been included early enough into the process to do it. So we're managing expectations of the design process, the brand owner, replicating more of what the printer really wants to show off. But the big outcome that we're delivering is we're eliminating rework.
cutting into your profitability.
Sure.
The printers today, and we have some major packaging suppliers and companies like MPS and WestRock and Amcor and Tetra Pak and they've been, you know, they're very skilled and they also work directly. And I've talked to a few of them on our podcast, and each one of them, there's a common thread that, you know, and it may sound cliche, but it's always communication, and transparency. So from the print service providers that are not, or that are trying to get a foothold in the consumer packaging industry, and they're buying equipment, making equipment purchases, capital equipment purchases, what advice could you give them as far as, you know, these are some things that you need to think about, or you should consider before you spend copious amounts of money and making radical changes in order to enter a market? You know, what's the foundation that they can look to before they start to build their programs?
That's a great question. I'll answer it this way. So one of the big trends that COG sees by working with all of these key stakeholders is that luxury and premium is becoming the new normal.
Well, I mean, I think of embellishments and
absolutely embellishments in the R&D packaging world. That's often referred to as decoration.
Okay.
But you're absolutely right. It's embellishments, it's coatings, finishes, substrates, creating a sense of a tactile feeling, a sense of touch, an attraction from a distance, from the shelf, anything that can attract you to pick it up. Of course, we're talking about in store. I mean, more and more products, you're viewing products online and they're arriving at your doorstep through Amazon, but still there are more and more use of embellishments, of exotic materials, films in packaging in every aisle, every single aisle, almost on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. You're seeing an elevated aesthetic. Now, every category has its own definition of luxury. I mean, not every category by any means has a wine and spirits or a cosmetic or a fragrance aesthetic. But the next time you walk down the oral care aisle, look at all the materials and the embellishments there.
Oh, yeah.
Look in the laundry and cleaning aisle. Look at what Downy is doing with shrink films and spot coatings. So every category has its sort of acceptable premium range, but you're seeing more and more of that across the board. So the first thing I would say is, you know, to printers and converters is, do you want to play there? Because if you want to play there, then you're talking about presses and finishing units that can achieve that. And then, you know, are you playing in the thousands or are you playing in the millions? Because then that helps. Obviously, they know the difference between what an HP can deliver versus what a Nilpeter, you know, with an ABG unit can deliver.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the main trend we're seeing is a move towards more and more luxury premium effects relative to the category so that it's not overpromising, not outlandish. And I think that's a good indicator of what type of end customer they want to go after and what sort of equipment and toolbox they're going to need to do that.
Looking at trends on our side, when I say our side, I mean the supplier side, we see trends in digital and we see inkjet. We see inkjet doing embellishments. There's products like Scotix and MGI. And then we have companies like Xerox and HP and you know, all these digital suppliers that were originally really, you know, making copiers. And now they have systems where I can print, you know, four color process, spot colors, then tactile spot coatings and metallic embellishments all in line. And we're not talking about volumes from these devices in the millions. Of course, if you have multiple, you're getting that. But we're talking typically, we're talking about short run, variable data applications and things like that. From your perspective, working with very, very large brands, and do you mind if I mention some of the people that you have worked with in the past?
Or is sure.
That, yeah. Coca-Cola, Domino's Pizza, Johnson & Johnson. You mentioned you worked for Procter & Gamble, U.S. Bank. And I mean, the list goes on and on as I look through your career. And when you working with them and then looking at the trends, I don't know if doing prototyping, I would assume that you guys are looking at these technologies not only for production, but also as a prototyping mechanism. Are the brands aware of this, or is this something that you present to them as alternatives? And again, it's in relation to the new technologies like the ones that I mentioned earlier.
I think generally speaking, the brands are aware of these new outstanding specialized capabilities, especially with regard to customization and embellishments. You know, they're shoppers too, and brands are very sensitive because when they see their competitors doing something that they're not doing, so they're aware of it. And, you know, their purchasing counterparts, colleagues are aware of it too. There is still a bit of a disconnect. Just because a printer invests in the equipment doesn't mean that printer necessarily is allowed to or comfortable forcing him or herself to have a seat at the table earlier in the process. So the equipment, the technologies out there, the end customer and their colleagues that help make those decisions like purchasing, they're aware of it, but there's still gaps in connecting the dots. Just like you said previously, communication, transparency is essential. Jeff, so's curiosity. You know, the curiosity that a brand owner or a purchasing person, in our opinion, that they should have, be curious about, you know, is my process actually allowing my suppliers who are excited and prepared and have invested, is my process allowing them to flourish? There's so much attention from the brand owner to the supplier, to the vendor. What can you do for me? But it goes the other way too. I mean, the end customer has to create the environment, you know, the towel, so to speak.
Yeah.
For that.
I kind of want to shift gears a little bit. You mentioned something, you mentioned the experience and, you know, I'm walking through an aisle, what will provoke me to, you know, interact with a package or product. And that leads me to the buzzword omnichannel. And what do you counsel or advise brands or even, you know, the print service providers that you're communicating with? How much does the social media aspect of advertising that product play into the packaging design?
That's a really interesting question. I think that, to be quite honest with you, in what we do right now, we're not expected. I can't recall a time when we're really expected to deliver an objective, like an end goal like that. But I will say that Amazon's influence on packaging design and development is part of that topic. There are changes being made to how products are delivered now through online purchase. Mm-hmm. Amazon has done a great job. It's been painful for a lot of brands, but they've done a great job of revealing what products out there, what brands out there are truly distinctive versus what products are commodities. And that comes across when Amazon is providing feedback that results in a brand reducing or altering their use of packaging or their type of packaging. But there still remain products that when we order them online, we want them to contain, you know, not just be a functional package, but also be an aesthetic package, something that validates their choice or validates their status. I think of wine and spirits. I think of cosmetic fragrance. There are still products that we want to display today and admire, and, you know, admire the packaging, where, and there are other products where the packaging has become less important. You know, mm-hmm. I just want the product. I don't need all this extra jazz.
So David, what are some of the products or prototypes that you work on at COG when you're dealing and collaborating with a major brand? And what are some of the challenges?
Wraps. And that has been a dominant trend in the last 10 years, moving away from rigids, rigid bottles, you know, rigid materials to flexibles. We also are really good at paperboard, cartonboard material. That said, there's been some advances in rigid packaging with the reuse of, you know, ocean and plastic that's collected from the ocean. Mm-hmm. And then there's another minor trend going on right now where rigids are being delivered with innovative use of paperboard and cartonboard. It's not all in one black and white direction. There's a major trend in rigids to flexibles. And then within that, there's some micro trends in trying to do rigids a little bit more responsibly. So that's our focus. And the equipment that we use allows us to do that. We rarely have to outsource anything. If we do, it's usually because we have to paint a bottle. And even that is somewhat of a soon-to-be obsolete process, painting. There's people that are, there are prototyping companies that are outstanding at painting. But the plastic companies are getting so much better at producing the brand desired color in that bottle, like very quickly. So that's the only area where we're currently having to outsource that I can recall. It's we have our own equipment to do labels, cartons. We can cut all of that. We can assemble. You know, one of our structural designers has worked in co-packing and fulfillment for years. So when we create a carton, we're creating it for the printer and the co-packer to just run with it. Not that it won't change 5% or 10%, but we're not just creating a six-sided box and slapping it together with Elmer's. You know, we're creating something with with the stakeholders down the line. So 10 years ago, when we started the company with a contract with P&G R&D Packaging, that's how we started the company, with an on-site at P&G's North American Packaging R&D headquarters, and with the specific intention of helping them identify and commercialize embellishments. Mm-hmm. It's then that we learned, you know, the trend is towards flexibles. That's exactly the same time when 3D printers started dropping in price, and everyone was just talking about they're going to get a 3D printer. And I can't tell you how many times we came so close to getting one, but because we were lean and starting out and we could only get like one piece of equipment at a time, we always gravitated towards, you know, another Roland. Our business model is really about improving the process, getting the most out of the printer and the designer, not necessarily about making stuff. We want to help designers do better work that's more feasible. We want to help the printer showcase more of what they can do, more of what they've invested in. And we want to help the end customer get to market faster and reduced time and cost.
If you were to point whether it's a print service provider or designer in the direction to become more, you know, educated and understanding of how to improve processes and improve efficiencies and reduce waste, would you, you know, send them, I mean, where can you get that kind of education? Is it, you know, continual improvement programs, Six Sigma, or is it, you know, trial and error? I mean, how do you get the mindset to be effective in improving processes in the area that you're an expert in?
You know, I think improvement process, training, conferences, those are great. But I think really at the end of the day, it's what It's what Dick Jackson told me, you know, my favorite boss ever, when he sat me down in my 20s and said, you know, you have to manage your career. You have to look at what your goals are now, and you have to manage your career. No one's, if you stay at an agency, if you stay with a P&G, they'll manage it for you and you'll have to live with what you get. I was really struck by that. And I guess maybe because I didn't go to design school, like I was a designer and an art director in New York, but I didn't go to design school. I studied medical illustration. So maybe because I didn't go to design school, I didn't drink the Kool-Aid and stay in that channel the whole time. But Dick really, he really impressed upon me that somehow it just turned into, his guidance turned into me having a curiosity in all aspects of my industry. And I think the more you can spend time on the client side, on the agency side, and the production side, you will naturally begin to develop a much greater perspective and ability to affect change. Well, before you finished that question, I was about to say standards and specifications don't impact prototyping and design enough. But then you change it to our company. We're still, that's what we strive for. We look for, we urge the design group, the end customer, to identify who the printer is for the job. They don't always reveal that. They don't always have it. Beyond the printing company and their capabilities and the specifications that they will ultimately hold design and brand owners accountable for, right? Beyond that, there's the end customer's manufacturing capabilities. Just because a multicolor or a CCL can print a 40 micron high build, mm-hmm, with its varnishes, it doesn't mean that the end customer's manufacturing facility is certified, has tested that micron height.
Right.
So all of that is essential. And it comes back to the end customer. The end customer and their brand owners and their purchasing people just can't put the onus on all of us. They have to change too. They have to be invested in this. It's not a one-way street, Jeff.
Yep. And when you look at brand color, we develop specifications. We have a think tank called the Print Properties and Color Metric Council that works on improving specifications and standards. Matter of fact, we're the largest contributor to international standards in this particular area. And right now, we still have a challenge on the print service provider side to, one, help them maintain color specifications and standards in a global market. I mean, we have suppliers, we have a product that's being printed in China, Vietnam, India, Europe, and the United States. And at the end of the day, they want them to look the same as far as their brand color is concerned and the quality of that, of the image. And that's what we promote. That's what we educate on. And there's still a challenge to deliver that and for print service providers to be able to improve their processes to maintain that accuracy and consistency,
sure,
across all of their plants. Then we've developed a program to educate the brand side called Brand Q. From your experience, how important is that color specification and understanding the standards and specifications on the brand side?
Well, it's extremely important. I can't reveal who it is or what company it is, but I just had a conversation last week with a gentleman with one of our end customers who's been working. He's been dedicated to this for the 10 years he's been with the company. And prior to that, he worked exclusively in the design, packaging design, and printing industries. He was brought in by this end customer, and he's been like a slow moving freight train, steadily making progress to implement consistent execution of brand colors across, all substrates. And, it's no surprise. It's been, it's been a challenge. It takes, it's funny, even today, Jeff, it still comes down to one person. Great things can be accomplished more from one person who's willing to put his or her neck on the line, from an internal perception and career advancement standpoint, much more so than a group. There's lots of teams and groups that meet to work this out, but it really comes down, it always, achieving great things and, color specifications and consistent execution of a brand color is an extremely important thing to do today, especially in light of how much easier it is for every brand to do, pretty good design work, even retailers. So any place where you can create an advantage and achieve ownership of colors like Coke Red, like Tiffany Blue, if you're a serious brand, you need to do it. And I know that I know in this one large company, there's someone who's dedicated to it and, he's going to get it done.
Right on. Excellent. And David, we've been talking for almost an hour. And if there's anything that we haven't discussed or I haven't proposed as a question that you would like to mention, whether it's a trend or an idea or a principle, you have the floor.
Thanks. I've got a good one, I think. Everyone's really interested and enamored and concerned about Amazon. And a few years ago, I had gotten to a point where I just felt like everyone was repeating the same information about Amazon that they were reading online. And I was lucky enough that Amazon's largest U.S. distribution center is right across the river in Hebron, Kentucky. Long story short, I wanted to learn more about Amazon, so I went to work for them. I worked for 5 months stacking pallets, loading trucks, unloading trucks, splitting packages coming down a conveyor. I worked in repairing damaged packages. I did what I could, and I realized that, I worked from 6:30 to 11:30, five nights a week. For I think it was 4 months, not five. Yeah, I made a little money. That was great. But what I really did, I really learned a lot. And it occurred to me, it's like what my mother would have told me, just do it. Just find a way to do it. Any brand manager from P&G or Kroger or Cal Brands in Cincinnati can do the same thing. And they can get a little sample of knowledge and that can go a long way. So I think there's lots of examples of that. Just be curious. Keep it simple. Don't be afraid to roll up your sleeves and don't rely on the internet for all your information.
Well said. And thank you for that. I'm glad I remembered to ask that.
Thank you. It was a real, I'm so honored that you asked me, and it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Gamut Podcast. If you have ideas, suggestions, or would like to join us or even sponsor future podcasts, simply email me at jcollins@idealliance.org. That's JCOLLINS@idealliance.org. Take care and have a productive day.